Welcome to Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio. Join us as we explore books and culture through engaging conversations with writers, historians, and creatives, offering unique insights into the literary arts and beyond. Hosted by Ken Budd, Jennifer DeSano, and William Miller. Now, here's the show.
Hello and welcome to Upstart Crow. I'm your host, William Miller, and my guest today is Margaret Hutton, whose fiction has appeared in numerous journals and magazines, including The Sun, The South Carolina Review, The Antioch Review, and Abundant Grace. Today, we're discussing her debut novel, If You Leave. Welcome, Margaret.
Thank you so much, Bill. I'm so happy to be here.
I got to tell you, I had a lot of fun reading and thinking about this novel. It is so textured and multi-layered, and it just seems like the more you think about it, the more it opens up. Let's start with the way art and war kind of both figure into this, if you don't mind.
Sure.
For one thing, you've vacillated or go back and forth between two time periods, 1973 and 1944. Two periods very heavily impacted by war, obviously World War II in 44, Vietnam in 73. Is there a reason why you did that?
Yeah, I mean, I was also just, there were a few things I was thinking about. One was, I wanted to write, I mean, just practically speaking, I wanted to write into a year that I remembered.
That wasn't 1944.
Not 1944. I knew I was going to start at the edge of the war because that was part of the tension of the story, you know, that these women were involved in working for the World War II effort, but not for long, you know, and whatever they were enjoying or learning or, you know, those, their economic independence, all those things were going to be sort of taken away from them soon. But the 73 and 74 were years that I thought were real kind of turning points in the country, right? So we remember in 74, Nixon resigned. That was something I really remembered, you know, watching and feeling. In 73, when this story wraps up, is in the final scenes, we're looking at Nixon's inauguration. And as this story deals with women and choice and agency and lack of those things, that became a really salient moment. So Nixon is inaugurated the day before one of these last scenes. And one of the characters is watching on television, a newscaster who she happens to know. And you just, there's one little gesture in the background of these justices in black robes. That's because the day after Nixon was inaugurated, Roe v. Wade was passed. And so that became this arc of the book for a very specific generation of women that I was interested in. And the other piece is how, you know, that arc was also related to how unmarried mothers were treated in the States. And it was, you know, and I did some research on this. In the first half of the century, women who were unmarried, it was almost like a reform effort. You know, the Florence Crittenden Homes were involved in this, and that's what Pennington is based on loosely. But women were, you know, the effort was to help the mother, reform the mother so she could, you know, come back in line and be a good mother, right? By the middle of the century, and by the middle, really, 1944, 45, 46, right in there, that shifted. There were a lot of variables going on. I don't think it was just one thing. But that's when the institutions began to really place newborns with couples. So, of course, that sort of shifted, too, in the mid-70s. So that, you know, 30-ish year arc, that was important.
Well, and of course, Vietnam was less so than World War II, but both of those wars were kind of catalytic, and that kind of opened your story up in terms of the change that happens to your two principal characters, Audrey and Lucille. I mean, wars, in effecto, are catalytic because they take the men away, and as you alluded to, the women then step up into different roles, and that gives them all kinds of variable factors in their lives.
Sure. I really think this has happened since the beginning of time. You know, men would go off and women would be left to take on all those roles that the men had done. And then they would come back and resume life as it was. I mean, there's been some research, I think, about World War I. This happened to the extent that organization that women took on and the new skills they learned led directly to, you know, their white women's gaining the right to vote. So these are definitely catalytic. This is very true. That right there was so interesting to me, you know, war as opportunity. And that's what it really was for these women. And I mean, as Audrey, I think, says pretty early on, you know, she wasn't really doing it to like help the country. She wanted to leave home and she wanted to go to a larger city where she had more opportunities to find her creative life and be an artist. You know, Lucille is rather sent away. So that's a little different. But for Audrey, certainly, she looks at it very opportunistically.
Well, and Lucille's sent away, but I mean, she's complicit in her being sent away.
Right. You know, she doesn't quite get over that. And I think she's not quite at home in her new place of Washington, D.C. She finds that concrete rather hard. And that plays into the story. She takes it also as an opportunity to just sort of start over, you know, cut some ties.
Or try to.
Doesn't quite work out that way.
Exactly. And that's part of her story is that vibrancy within her, the push and pull back and forth between where she's from and the new life she's trying to build for herself. But she does say at one point that she wanted to start over, that this is something she wanted. And wants play a big role in the storyline as you fashion it. And so does, in, if you will, seeing. The opening scene is really sort of interesting, the way you, I don't know how you wrote it. I'll come back to that question in a second. I just want to establish what the scene is. You've got Audrey as a painter, but she's also working in the studio and she's vacuuming and a customer comes and knocks on the door and he wants to get in and look at paintings and he wants to buy an anniversary present for his wife and himself. And he actually looks at something that she painted and wants to get it. But there is kind of a mystery that you create there in alluding to the painting because he sees something. I mean, he talks a bit about it, but more specifically, she painted it. She knows what's under the layers of paint. And your last lines of that chapter are really sort of beguiling to me in the sense of, you know, what she can see from what she knows about the painting.
Right. And, you know, the reader eventually understands, but that is a mystery initially. And yeah, that scene was interesting to write because I felt strongly that Audrey, this artist, be still somewhat confined in 1973, some domestic chores like vacuuming and to be interrupted. You know, she's also kind of imagining some work she might produce and wanting to sketch something. And those thoughts are interrupted by a man. So all of that was sort of speaks to, you know, bigger things in the book. But yeah, the rowboat and the layers and how that comes back into play in the final scenes of the book.
Very interesting. But the theme of art comes in. I mean, on page 250, you start chapter 33 with a quote from Cezanne about objects penetrate one another. They do not cease to live, you understand. They spread imperceptibly around them by intimate reflections.
Isn't that great?
Isn't it great?
Cezanne, yeah.
Did you just happen upon that or did you spend hours Googling?
No, I did have that book of letters and I just liked the way it spoke to obviously what is happening in the scene. Audrey really wanting to, you know, carve out time to work. And as a creative person and as a writer, that, you know, was just another disruption, right? She's in that studio. She's dreaming of Cezanne and this conversation he's having with Gasquet. And the neighbor knocks on the door and says, well, I knew you weren't busy. I knew you were just staring into space. You know, and if that's not the writer's dilemma, daily. I don't know what it is. So that was a lot of fun to write. You know, there's just this interconnectedness, you know, that sort of hovers around this book. And thematically, that's such a big deal to me. And I just loved those words about the way you look at something and it seeps into, you know, the lines seep into each other, and it speaks to the ripples of these lives and the past and present creeping into each other constantly with, you know, the way the book moves back and forth. And I mean, on so many levels. So that passage was particularly apt.
Well, and in fact, it kind of speaks metaphorically, doesn't it, to Audrey and Lucille's interactions and the way their lives connect?
Completely, yeah.
So the neighbor comes and interrupts and just assumes that Audrey's not doing anything, just like the guy in the at the beginning of the book knocks on the door when she's vacuuming, and he assumes she's a clerk in an art studio. She signs her painting just with her initials and last name, not with her full name. So he wouldn't necessarily get it, but he just assumes. And I think that's part of the environment into which you're writing in this time period about what the assumptions we made about women, and maybe to some degree still do today.
Right. Yes, for sure. And, you know, it was a time when there's another scene where, you know, Audrey is ready to present her work in a gallery. And there's great detail about how, well, she was kind of going to be sandwiched in there between two men's work, and she was not going to be, they weren't even going to paint the walls between those two shows, but this was her chance, you know? And I think that was, I mean, that was completely made up, but that was also how difficult it was to be noticed as a woman artist in 1973. And there's, you know, still we write today about how, you know, more men are represented. This does go on.
There's also a third character. I think of this as the, if you will, this story is the evolution of largely three female characters, the two we've talked about, and also Lake. And I'm hemming and hawing a little bit because I don't want to give too much away. But at the end, Lake has essentially come more into her own by being on a stage. In other words, it's on the proscenium that she finds something approximating happiness for herself.
That's right. I love that expression, on the proscenium. Yes. And I think this has been developing throughout, you know, the book. I mean, you see, well, certainly as Lake ages, you know, you have that early scene where she's acting out Persephone and Demeter to really kind of astounding effect, if you think about it. You know, she takes on both Persephone's role, which is the one she's playing, and she takes on Demeter's, which is kind of extraordinary that she's putting herself in the place of this mother who's lost her daughter, and she's playing the lost daughter. So it's developing, but, you know, there is that tension between wanting to be someone else, wanting to try on someone else, but also being good at it. I mean, I think by the time this story is, we reach this end, Lake has really kind of benefited. I mean, she would not be going off to Russia in this particular role had she not suffered these losses. And there's a lot of sadness and there's, you know, grief in that and heartache, but, you know, it is part of her making, right? That she is able to turn a thing over and consider it from these different angles and use that on the stage. So that just speaks to the greater sort of, I guess, themes of leaving in the book that are not one-dimensional for sure.
Well, leaving and returning, very important. Those actions are very important, both emotionally and physically in the book.
I mean, every character pretty much leaves at some point, gets to leave, tries to leave, wants to leave.
Hence the title.
I mean, you know, I think Ben is a character who doesn't quite leave. You know, he does go into the service. He's commissioned for a year. I think he sort of suffers in a way because he doesn't leave. You know, he's never left his mother's house. He's still, you know, kind of weighed down by her things and those, you know, I mean, everything around him is what he grew up with. And so there's a certain stuntedness, I think, to his character. I mean, we don't know, you know, he's a very secondary character. So we only have a little bit of his interiority, but I think that is a slight difference in how leaving affects the rest of the characters.
Well, I mean, he's secondary, but so is Arthur, his counterpart, his male counterpart, if you will.
Right.
And that's in secondary. But you do use the men as catalysts and their comings and goings. It goes back to the war theme, the comings and goings, whether it's to go off to war or whether it's to, you know, interact with the woman and cause something to happen in her life. They are catalytic. They are determinants.
Sure.
Why do you give them such an outsized role? They're like ants at the picnic.
I guess I think that, you know, I started the book thinking, oh, there are going to be no men in here. You know, none. We're not going to have any. But, you know, I think women's lives in 1944 were rather dominated by men. You know, Lucille's very much under the, you know, I don't want to say tyranny of her father, but there is, you know, she is at his mercy. And she is, you know, Arthur has come into her life as a much older man. And I meant to look at this title, but there's a, I think it was called When We Were Young. It was a memoir written by someone who lived in this period and was, you know, probably an adolescent in the 40s. And she wrote about how often, you know, older men just have just groped and just, you know, did this. This was like just to be expected. And I was rather, you know, surprised by that. But I was thinking of that a lot as I was imagining Lucille and Arthur's story. You know, the first, I mean, of course, Arthur has known Lucille since she was a child. So he knows exactly how old she is. But when they first have that, you know, sort of physical interaction, she's made up and probably looks much older, but he's well aware. And, you know, at the same time, he does, I think, care about her. He comes to care about her. I mean, what he asks her to do in terms of being secretive with her family is rather abhorrent. And she is, we would say, too young to really be making decisions like this. But ultimately, he does want to be with her. And so that's interesting, but perhaps not typical, you know, the way this story might usually get told.
Well, one of the scenes, though, that really, really struck me was, because you don't render it as a scene per se, but you have lines, and I created this scene when she's 5 years old and he's hoisting her up onto right. the quote, slow mare on right. the farm so that she can go riding around and be safe.
Yeah, so that's, you know, what more can I say?
Well, so that we don't leave readers thinking he's a pedophile. I mean, even when she gets into her 20s and he's kind of courting her and he comes to, after she's gone to D.C. and he comes to sort of court her, he's respectful of her physical self, if you will.
Right, yeah, it's another sort of contradiction, you know, and made him not just villainous. And some of that is also just Southern female archetype of, you know, wanting a woman who's pure. So there is something self-serving in that too. He may be unique in preserving, you know, caring to preserve that to the extent that he does, given the relationship they're in.
Well, that's very interesting then to hear you say that, because we think about him and his wanting, in a sense, purity, even as he's corrupting that purity, but only to a certain line, versus Ben, who plunges in full-scale corruption.
Right. You know, he makes assumptions.
Ben does.
Yeah. And he trusts his assumptions. You know, he's fairly experienced and he thinks, oh, I've got this right. And, you know, he doesn't. And he's surprised by that. But
and I guess part of the difference is you're in your characterization here, you've got Arthur who's he doesn't own the farm, but he works the farm for Lucille's father. And then you've got Ben, who's a doctor, who presumes to know. And he's a surgeon, and not all of his patients survive.
Right.
So he knows a lot about life and death and presumes to know maybe even more than he does. There's a lot of rich characterization there, even in these male characters who, as I say, play these catalytic roles, but as you said, are kind of minor, but they're so important in the lives of the women they interact with.
Yeah. I was thinking recently, you know, just reflecting on, I think Ben has a little bit of a perfectionist streak. To me, the most egregious thing he does is never really acknowledge, you know, Audrey's sacrifice. The position he's put her in. I mean, it's just really awful the way he never really acknowledges that. But I think it's hard for him to admit sort of his own failure. You know, we know privately that he doesn't necessarily grieve the losses of his patients, but they matter. But we only know that because we know his private thoughts. It's not something he would probably publicly share. And I think that his failure with Lucille and the way Blake comes about is disagreeable to him. And so he can't really acknowledge it fully. And that means he doesn't acknowledge Audrey's life-saving role, frankly. But it's unfortunate. It doesn't, you know, that doesn't go well, right?
Well, there are two things that your comment brings to mind. One is Ben has an assistant who is aware of his shortcomings in the OR, and he has a sexual relationship with her. Whatever shortcomings he does or doesn't have in that realm, she thinks, well, okay, he's not going to marry me. But when he says he's marrying Audrey, she's like taken aback because she thought, well, he won't marry me, but he won't marry someone else.
Right.
And yet he does.
You know, we don't really know like what transpires between this assistant and Ben throughout the rest of Ben's married life. You know, Audrey's pretty convinced she knows. Blake is pretty convinced she knows. And part of that, having multiple points of view, the wonderful thing about that is the reader is always aware that not everybody has all the information. And there's some missing pieces. I mean, I don't really believe Ben carries on much of an affair, but it's questionable. And it's clearly a difficult relationship. This woman ends up, ultimately, she does marry someone else. She remains his friend. All that's, you know, again, just there's a whole scene, right, that doesn't get into the novel, but the reader, I hope, you know, imagines, tries to understand.
Before we move away from Ben, but he's a bit self-destructive.
Mm.
The drinking and the...
Right.
Mostly the drinking, I think.
So I think, you know, these things that happen, right, they're both who you are and what happens to you. So, you know, as I portrayed Ben, he is rather stunted in some ways. But I think this goes sort of how he turns out, goes back to, you know, Lucille and Audrey not having a lot of choice and agency. When people make poor decisions, and now I'm really talking about Lucille and or Ben making poor decisions, we think, well, they just, you know, that's on them. They have to face the consequences. They have to assume responsibility. And that's true. They do. But when, because of those poor decisions, you know, they're sort of forced into these corners, and Audrey is forced into a corner, regardless of her decisions, you know, everybody suffers. And to me, Ben is a character who, this is an example of a man who suffers because of the restrictions on reproductive freedom for women. You know, we forget the number of lives affected by that. So by the end, you know, the women, and I don't mean to give anything away at all, but they sort of muddle through, you know, and Ben seems to be more deeply saddened or bereft by what his life, you know, what he had hoped for. He's aspirational. Didn't happen.
And I have some sympathy for him.
Absolutely. I do too.
But talking about what you were just saying, I return to the Cézanne quote that you have on page 250 about objects penetrating one another. I mean, this book is about how people affect each other's lives.
Right. And knock them off track.
Exactly. I mean, if we think about Ben and Lucille and Audrey, Audrey is like the most innocent of the three, and yet her life gets totally thrown off track by what Ben and Lucille do.
Right. I mean, some of this story became about, you know, are we really the best judges of how our lives should go? We know Lucille from the start of the novel really wants a family. She's got that sort of caregiving aspect to her, and she flat out wants it, and she's clear about that. But her life does not really allow her to embrace that, right? Audrey doesn't want it. She wants to create other things. But she has these qualities that are quite good as a mother. You know, she's very stable. She's very solid. She's very kind of still and fixed. Those are great attributes for a mother. She does pretty well. And so, you know, one of my early epigraphs was a line from Penelope Fitzgerald's Beginning of Spring, life makes its own corrections. And I think about that a lot. I don't think that ultimately is the comment on the novel, but I was thinking about that. You know, how much do you have to want to be a mother to be a good mother? You know, Audrey says, well, you need to be a presence and maybe an example of how to live a life, you know? And ultimately, for all her resistance, you know, she does okay by Lake. Maybe I'm giving too much away.
Well, I hope we're encouraging people who haven't read it and who see or hear this will go out and get the book and read it, because it's well worth it. But since you just linked Lake and Audrey together in that way, Lake does, in a sense, criticize Audrey, though, and say she wished she had a mother who wanted a child.
Yeah. She goes through her, is it just teenage rebellion? Is it legitimate? This person is not focused on me. You know, Audrey tries to be honest. She tells her the truth, which is probably unusual, you know, especially for that time. But Audrey didn't want to set up any false notions, right? So she's honest that, well, I'm Audrey and your mother's Lucille, and here's a portrait of her hanging on the wall. I mean, it's very strange, right?
Right.
So that sets up, I think, fair or not, I mean, I think it's okay for Lake, you know, to the point I made earlier about how she is able to use this in her life and her artistic life later. But it sets up a good bit of longing. Like, where is she? I know you don't really want to be here. Again, back to, you know, Audrey's solidity. You know, she's not the warmest, but she's there.
I don't think there's any way, though, that a person in the role of a mother can say to a person in the position of being that mother's child, I didn't really want you, whether it's directly or not. I mean, let's say, for example, you know, that you're a natural mother, you know, you're the birth mother of this, of a child. And at some point, the child comes to the mother and says, did you really want to have me, you know, for whatever reason, like, you know, you're the only child or you're the fourth or something like that.
After 12 years or.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the mother says, well, I mean, you know, we hadn't exactly planned it, that kind of thing. I mean, you can have the same kind of reaction.
I think Audrey does her best to temper any of that. But part of it is an artist's life is distracted, right? Audrey is perhaps not in the moment as an artist and not with this child. And I think that must add some of this. There's a really interesting book by Julie Phillips called Baby on the Fire Escape about a lot of women in the mid-20th century, but artists, writers. It's quite a survey, but the two extreme examples are Alice Neal, who was an unconventional mother by any account. The title comes from this accusation from her in-laws that she put her baby on the fire escape in order to finish a painting. Presumably, she put the child in a carrier, and you know, this was never proven. But you know, there is that need for some artists to have a divider, you know, between child and work in order to get it done. I mean, she's painting toxicity. I mean, there's maybe this real practical reason. Now, A.S. Byatt is also surveyed in this book, and she says, she's a writer, a little different. I just put the baby on the desk. I just wrote with the baby on the desk. And that is, you know, a different way. I mean, I think some women are very capable, some mothers are very capable of using that maternal energy in a creative way, using that. It's not an interference. They make that work toward that enterprise. You know, I think Audrey tries it both ways, right? She's trying to paint with Lake at her feet and, you know, between Lake and the outside world, that gets interrupted. And then later, Lake is, if she were to come up to Audrey's studio, she'd see the sign that says, do not disturb.
Lest we give artists a bad reputation here. I mean, I know a woman who was just a housewife in the 1950s, and she had two kids, and they were, you know, fairly close together. And she liked to go out and socialize and play cards and things like that. And she would take her kids and have them play in the yard. And in one case, they didn't have a fenced-in yard for them to play in, so she tied them to a tree. But the rope was too long, and they were playing in the road. So, you know, somebody pointed this out.
Of course. And I have horrible family tragedy story in my own family. You know, I'm sure they're of, you know, someone who can't watch children 24 hours a day. I think what I'm talking about is just sort of picking up on, you know, Lake is in a position to sort of in her environment detect that unwantedness. And so she's, her radar's up for that.
It's her neediness.
Yeah. She's going to misinterpret perhaps. Yeah.
Yeah. But part of what you pursue informs this. You are a painter yourself.
Right. You know, that all came about so interestingly because I have no aptitude as naturally as a child. I had no interest. But when I was in college, I read Flannery O'Connor's work and was pretty taken with the just exquisite, you know, ness of her sentences and read her essays in several times. She says, if you want to write, you should draw. You should look at a thing really closely, observe it. That is going to make you a much better writer. So I was desperate to do anything. And I thought, well, I'll try this. And it turned out I just liked the process. You know, I liked the materials. I liked the way it slowed me down. I probably did make me somewhat more observant. You know, I pursued it for a while. And then in the middle of writing this book, I thought, you know, I can't do two things that don't make any money. So I'm not going to pursue the art for a while. But it is one reason why I wanted an artist at the center of the book. I almost wanted to like live vicariously through her. And then when I finished, you know, had a real draft, I sort of dug back into the art and started working at the Washington Studio School. And definitely, you know, but for the dormancy of this, for the time being, you know, we'll continue to pursue it. It's funny, you know, I think the novel is visually descriptive. I think it's certainly that. Someone the other night, though, pointed out that I'm not particularly generous with descriptions of characters. They thought that was perhaps a good thing because they weren't distracted by that. But it is true that I have not, don't spend a lot of time detailing the faces of characters. But part of that is the way I think people are perceived more than they're closely seen. I think the space someone takes up is maybe more important than a specific facial feature. You know, the way they move. I mean, for instance, when Daniel is recognized by Lucille in a late scene, it's not his face. It's the way he's holding his body, one shoulder higher than the other. Things like that are so much more how they move in the world and how they hold themselves and how present they are. Seems to me to be more descriptive of character than perhaps facial features.
Well, not only descriptive, but I would say evocative of character, you know, particularly when, in this story that you tell here, where character is so important. This is, I won't say subtle in a sense, but if you do have to sort of stop and think about this book to understand the layering and the complexity and to appreciate the beauty of it, I did not miss those descriptions of characters in the sense of I was aware they weren't there. But I didn't miss them because, as you say, you portray the characters and the space and the way they inhabit the world. And that seemed to me to be so much more provocative of the characters that I was able to see them and feel them and get inside them, if you will.
Imagine them a little bit more, perhaps, without those fixed or such precise, I guess, descriptors. That's what you want the reader to be able to move among them, right? And be right there.
Right. Well, and I know that there are writers who do it differently, who, you know, bring the character onto the stage and stop the action and say, you know, she's this, she's that, she has this, she wears this, and she does her hair and, you know, whatever, so that the reader gets that sort of movie-esque physical image and then go on with the action. I think Alan Tuse taught at George Mason for years, was a proponent of that school because he really was a proponent of writing in scenes. And so that's one way.
Yeah. And I'm so interested in interiority. You know, I think that is really what distinguishes the novel and fiction from a lot of other media. Just that access to another person's interior, their thoughts. We don't have it in daily life. You know, we live with people for decades and we still don't know what's in there. In a novel, you can get in there, you know, and just started. I think the first book that kind of marks this is Tale of Genji, and I've just started it. It's a long one, but, you know, that was new, brand new that the novel brought on the scene. And I think it's one of its lasting and incredible contributions.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that one of the roles of serious-minded fiction is interiority, to get the reader into the interior of a character's life. And if we hope, as we do, that reading fiction builds empathy, then I think you've got to get into interiority. You've got to evoke that in a way that connects with the reader. And it seems to me that they go hand in hand, that if you write in such a way that the reader is pulled into the characterization and into the story and into the interior of the characters, it's a way of signaling to the reader, hey, look deeper.
Yeah.
Don't just look superficially at the characters, but look deeper. Think about those. Your book has a wonderful depiction of an oil painting on the front. Did you create that? How did that come about, that cover?
So it is not my work. This publisher creates all their own covers. They're always amazing. So I had a lot of trust. I'm sure writers often come with ideas, right? They know what should be on the cover. I honestly did not feel strongly initially. I wasn't intent on creating the cover when I got this book under contract. And I think I will feel differently about it the next time around. But anyway, they're pretty clear, you know, we're going to do what we're going to do and it's going to work out because we know what we're doing. But they do ask for a fair amount of collaboration, which I found really fun and interesting. So I was clear that I wanted a cover with color. I was afraid that given the historical aspect of it, they would want to put it in black and white or sepia toned. And I thought that is so beautiful. I mean, I do love that, but it's, you know, I'm practical too. And I know I am really drawn to color. I'm going to look twice at that. So that was important. I wanted the human touch of brushstroke. I was pretty adamant about that I just straight lines and, you know, I wanted to feel that touch. And then I had the idea of an unfinished portrait and it's Lake. I've had, you know, people are like, well, wait, who is that on the cover? And it's interesting because, you know, Lake does not have a point of view in this book. These two other women do. And I wouldn't know which one to choose to put on the cover. Lake, as the book, when the book begins, feels unfinished. And she's like closer to sort of becoming herself by the end of the book. So this is an unfinished portrait of her. But yeah, I've had people guess different who it is.
I like that. I like that it's Lake. And you say she doesn't have her point of view, but it is represented. I mean, indirectly.
Right.
But I think that's good. And I think also this representation of her on the cover is somewhat indirect because it is unfinished and there's a kind of a canvassy rip that goes through it diagonally. And the top of it emerges as a person's face and the bottom hasn't yet taken form. So it's not just unfinished. The bottom part's unformed.
Right, right.
Cool. Good work. How did you write this book? Because in case readers haven't caught on, it goes back and forth between the two large time periods, and it also alternates points of view within those time periods. Did you write it that way, or did you write it out sequentially?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote it out. I tried it a number of ways. Let's just say I tried this story a number of ways. Chronologically, I had, you know, I didn't call it a prologue, epilogue, but I had sort of the 1973 period broken up into, you know, start of the book, end of the book. And finally, you know, that just didn't work. And so I started interleaving these, you know, the past or the present into the past, I guess, vice versa. And that started to work. And it, you know, you mentioned this push-pull of the characters earlier, this sort of back and forth in time, express that structurally. And you want the structure to have some meaning, right? You want it to speak to something greater. And I think it does that. And the past is always, you know, right there. It's always coming up behind them. They're not free of it. They're not really moving forward for most of the story. So that seemed like a structure that worked. But it meant that a lot of that 73 part was written in the latter part of the process. Because once I realized I was really going to have to divide this up, the structure is the hardest part. I think it's always the hardest part about, you know, a book or even a story. It's that 28 years. What are we going to leave out? What are we going to include?
And how do you, in 28 years, how do you account for the time that passed in between? How do you represent that?
Right. yeah, there's a chunk of the story where one of the characters is really not around. So then it becomes a bit more episodic. But yeah, the last third was a work in progress right up to the end. I mean, I tell people I really did not have a story when I started. You know, I was groping and I was like E.L. Doctorow says, I was driving at night without the lights on. I could only see that far, you know, in front of me. And I kind of went a whole way like that. But, you know, the final scenes, the last third, certainly written last.
Well, you say you were driving without the lights on, but I mean, what was the seed of the story? I mean, did you have a character, someone you knew who, you know, I mean, what was the seed of it?
Yeah, there were a couple seeds. I mean, one was just place and living in Washington. And I had a friend who lived in McLean Gardens. And we had been in that space. We'd been in those apartments. It wasn't then that I learned this. It was years later when I learned that they were, you know, built in 1942. That whole complex is lovely for people who haven't seen it. It's like red brick, colonial, two stories, grassy area, several acres. It was built in 1942 by the government for women to live in when they came to Washington to work. And this was just astonishing to me. I mean, it housed like 3,500 women. Then I came to learn it wasn't the only one like it in the area. So immediately I had this, how that would be great to be, you know, from a small town across the country and get to come to Washington, hop on a train or bus and have a job and meet all these new people and learn new skills and have my own money. And that seemed right for story. Surely there were a few men around, you know, I could come up with and create some drama. And like I said earlier, you know, the war was not going to last forever. So there was built-in tension. I mean, visually, I immediately had an image of a woman on a, you know, in one of those, the apartment windows kind of curled in the window. And she was smoking and regretting her decision to marry someone overseas whom she didn't know well. And, you know, in my own life, I mean, I have my grandparents were about 10 years older than these women. So I did not think about them a lot, but since writing it, I've thought about them so much. In particular, one who I think, you know, really would, I'm so much more sympathetic to her as a person, where she's no longer alive. Thinking about her life in terms of how limited she was in her choices and what was available for her to do. She would have been a great CEO. She could have gotten a PhD in history. Instead, she rather unhappily got married at 19 and had children at 21 and or started to have children at 21. And she was a wonderful grandmother to me. I think she was sort of looming in the background a bit. She filed for divorce in 1977, which was not the done thing. So she was hovering back there. And I ache for her, you know.
I have to ask, she filed for divorce in 77. I assume that was granted and she moved off on her own?
Mm-hmm. I mean, she did remarry, not right away, but yeah. I mean, she was like 62 or something.
That's bravery.
That's right. These are things you just sort of take for granted and you're growing up. I mean, I'm sure it was a big deal. I didn't necessarily think it was that big of a deal, but I look at her life a little differently now. That was, you know, it was really just the opportunity for, well, thinking of war as opportunity and what a, you know, I could do something with that. I was also thinking about men who did not, you know, I did so much research. We haven't talked about that. A lot of research because I didn't know a lot about the period. And I think Studs Terkel has an oral history that I read. And I think that's where I remember learning that, of course, not every man wanted to fight. Not every man wanted to join forces. And some of the enlisted guys would go on these ships and the officers are, you know, would have to take away their, or would feel the need to take away anything that they might use for self-harm. And I wasn't going to write about that. Men who weren't interested or couldn't or didn't want to live up to that masculine ideal. But what's the female equivalent of that? And I was a mother and I really wanted to be a mother, but what if I didn't? You know, what and how does society require that of women and ask them to, you know, give of their whole bodies? And what if you don't want that? So I think that's how these women were sort of came into being. You know, it's funny, so much of the writing initially, because it was just about setting, was unconscious. And I would set these scenes. I had the blood donation scene fairly early. I didn't know its purpose necessarily, but, you know, it does sort of metaphorically come into play. You put it out there and then you sort of, I call it, you know, I take my metal detector and I'm like going over it. Like, what is a value here? What can I hold on to? What does have meaning? And that was, you know, I think a clue of what their relationship might become.
You mentioned the research. Talk about that a little bit more, because you said you weren't that familiar and familiar with it, and yet you've evoked it very richly.
You know, research is a great procrastination tool. So at least, you know, I mean, I certainly used that throughout. But initially, the very first book I read was David Brinkley's Washington Goes to War. And that was foundational because it's, you know, this small town. And David Brinkley has moved up from North Carolina. He's a journalist. Daniel is inspired by him, you know, just that small part of his story. But it was a wonderful book. And in fact, there's an anecdote in that book where Brinkley tells a story of another reporter who goes to rent a room on Wyndham Place, which is a street off Massachusetts Avenue in Washington. And this woman says, you know, here's the extra room I have to rent. Here's my room. And they're adjoined. They're sliding doors between them. If we can keep this open, I'll give you this room for half off. This other reporter got the sense, you know, she's a lonely woman. She's married to a major who's overseas somewhere, and he thinks that's a really bad idea. So that was, you know, boarding house, what happens if a man were to join, you know, the tenants. It didn't, you know, it's not in the book like that, but that was an inspiration then. I mean, I watched movies. The More the Merrier was the great one about the housing crunch, so to speak, you know, of these women who are piling in to apartments. They don't have enough places to live. The Pentagon was a big book by Steve Vogel that was crucial for some of the scenes. But I would go down rabbit holes, you know, to write Ben's appendectomy scene. I went to the National Library of Medicine. I watched videos from the late 1930s of surgeons conducting appendectomies. They were instructional videos, you know, they were showing exactly how to do it. And that's all in there. And you know this, like you want, your research can really weigh something down. You want it to have meaning. And so that scene, something did come of that. You know, that's where Ben, he's thinking about wounds and holes and repair and tying it up and binding. And so that's how he arrives at taking care of Lake. And so that was useful. But there was a thing called the internet that just grows and grows. So,
or as we call it, the WWW. But did you do some research and write a whole scene based on that research and then figuring to put it in the novel and then realize it had no place and you had to take it out?
Oh, well, I did some research for a large section that I ended up cutting. It was really Lake's point of view. She goes out west and that just got completely dropped. I just was careful. You know, I just wanted it to be character driven the whole way. And I feel like by the time I really got to writing, I had kind of honed that sense of what was important and what wasn't.
So very directed at that stage.
Yeah. But, you know, even the final like hours of fact checking this, I was thinking about buses and streetcars. And I knew like they both were in Washington in the 40s. But, you know, I went back online one more time. And sure enough, there's a map from 1942. And I could like reroute every time one was used and make sure, you know, that sort of thing. I did get it right. I don't think it added anything. But I'll talk about this, you know, and you, I don't know if you agree. I don't really think fiction's job is to get it right. You know, we don't want to be called out. We don't want to draw the reader out of the dream, right? I'm not going to put a color television in 1944. But, you know, I'm building a mood and atmosphere. And if that street corner is, it's better off not there like it was, then I'm not going to, you know, describe it there as it was, right? I hope to deliver the mood, the atmosphere for the meaning, instead of just trying to get it all perfectly as it was.
Well, my way of putting it is that our job is to get it representationally correct.
Yeah.
I didn't notice anything that jumped out at me that said, you missed anything.
Good.
Well, thank you very much. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's been great to talk to you. You have amazing questions. I really appreciate, you know, just the care you've taken with the reading.
So to reiterate, the book by Margaret Hutton is If You Leave. It's published by Regal House Publishing, and it's available wherever books are sold. If you go to your bookstore and they don't have it, get them to order it, because it's well worth reading.
Thank you, though.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Upstart Crow. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Your feedback helps others find the show. Be sure to follow us on social media and check out our website at upstartcrow.org for more information on our episodes, guests, and ways you can support the podcast. You'll find all of the links in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time right here on Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio.